This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Human trafficking is a multi-billion dollar a year industry that forces the most vulnerable in our society, including millions of children, into modern-day slavery for labor or for sex. And it exists throughout our region, even here in Greater Cincinnati. Joining me first to talk about the scope of the problem and efforts to stop it, Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine. Good afternoon.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Most of us have a general idea of what human trafficking is, but how do we actually define human trafficking? What exactly does it involve?
Well, the Ohio Revised Code does have a definition, but the way I explain it is that human trafficking is compelling another human being to do something significant against their will, have sex, to work. You know, these are probably the two most common forms of human trafficking. It's not, you know, we think sometimes it has to be some, you know, exotic place overseas where this human trafficking is occurring. I mean, the sad truth is that human trafficking occurs, you know, many times right in front of our own nose here in Ohio, and you know, we fail to recognize it. You know, if your house is burglarized and you come home and you see the lock is jimmied and, you know, you see that your stuff is gone, you know what to do. You call the police. There's been a breaking and entering. But if you go in to get your nails done and look around and you see, you know, sleeping bags on the floor or in another room, indicating that the workers there actually sleep in the facility and they don't speak English and they don't make eye contact, how many among us thinks, oh, that must be human trafficking? And, you know, those are pretty good signs of human trafficking. So part of the challenge is to get everyone of us to start thinking about human trafficking, that this is something that does occur in Ohio.
How widespread is it in Ohio? Any idea?
No, it's no, you know, it's very difficult to determine how widespread. I think, you know, you're going to find human trafficking basically any place where the interstate highways go. So our major cities are obviously the prime targets. But, you know, it can take many forms. You know, the runaway 15-year-old girl who gets on a bus and ends up halfway across the country. You know, why she's running away doesn't matter, but she gets off, and at that bus station there's a woman who befriends her and then, you know, turns her into, you know, a slave, a human trafficked slave. So it can take many, many different forms, and there's certain individuals in certain situations who are certainly more vulnerable than others are.
Yeah, you know, it's so hard to believe that in this day and age that this type of crime is still taking place. I mean, why is it so difficult to nip in the bud? Because, like you were saying earlier, a lot of this flies under the radar?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think we think about human trafficking. We all know about, you know, what you do if you're mugged or what happens if someone is raped. What we don't think about is, well, what really constitutes human trafficking? You know, the case that Joe Dieters and I announced last week was probably one of the worst things we've ever seen. You know, we had a mom who trafficked her 11-year-old daughter to her drug dealer in exchange for heroin. You know, the drug dealer, we allege, you know, sexually exploited the young lady, and the mom was conscious about it and made a decision to do it to get heroin to feed her drug habit. So, you know, in that particular case, you have two great Ohio tragedies coming together, heroin addiction and human trafficking.
Yeah, this is all very, very tragic. What's being done at the state level to fight human trafficking?
Well, my predecessor in office set up a commission. Mr. Cordray set up a commission to deal with human trafficking. That was a very good thing to do. We have changed the laws in Ohio to make it you know, easier to get convictions in regard to human trafficking, and to make it clear that you know, someone who is a minor, you know, no longer do you have to prove you know, specific intent. What you simply have to prove is that this child was a child, and that, you know, they are a victim. So the other thing that we've done besides, you know, change the law in Ohio, I think there's two other main things. One is it's getting a lot more publicity because of shows like this and because the news media has turned its, you know, its lights directly on human trafficking. That is a very very, very good thing. The other thing, we have set up a unit in the Attorney General's office where we, you know, focus on human trafficking. We work directly with local law enforcement to try to deal with this problem.
How much has it helped to change the view of victims of human trafficking as being victims in need of help as opposed to prostitutes?
I think that's a big part of it. You know, I think that's part of the cultural change that has to take place in any state. You know, we have to have that cultural change to get people to think, look, if this is a child, you know, she's being coerced just by definition of the fact that she is a child. She's being coerced to have sex. And the guy who causes her to do that, you know, we need to show him no mercy. And, you know, if he's doing it, he's liable for what her age is. And, you know, we should not have to actually, you know, prove specifically that this was against her will. I mean, the whole idea is that, you know, if it's a child, it pretty much by definition is against her will, her informed consent.
Last question for you. What more do you think we need to do in dealing with this problem? What more can we do?
I think a lot more publicity, a lot more focus. You know, these are tough cases. You know, we're making more progress. But frankly, we need to continue to educate the public. We need to make sure that every police officer, you know, understands what human trafficking is and what the signs are.
Thank you for talking with us today.
Great to be with you. Thank you very much.
Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine. Joining us now to look at the problem in our region and what legal and social actions and programs are being used to fight human trafficking are Aaron Meyer, Coalition Manager for the Anti-Human Trafficking Coalition End Slavery Cincinnati, Julie Wilson, Chief Assistant Prosecutor and Public Information Officer with the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office, and Cincinnati Union Bethel Executive Vice President and Director of the agency's Off the Streets program, Mary Carol Melton. Aaron, Julie, and Mary Carol, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you.
You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And I'd like to know what your thoughts were about what the Attorney General had to say. Julie, why don't we start with what your thoughts are?
Well, we agree with Mr. DeWine and certainly appreciate the assistance we get from the state level to help us here with our local problems. Mr. DeWine has been very involved with a lot of initiatives in Hamilton County. We certainly appreciate his support and help on this particular issue. As he said, very disturbingly in Hamilton County, we had a recent case. Mr. Dieters and Mr. DeWine just announced the indictment of a mother and the drug dealer who she used in the trafficking of her young daughter. It's very, very sad, very disturbing. But as Mr. DeWine said, it's important for people to know, unfortunately, this is a problem. It is something that is in our area, and we really need all hands on deck, you know, law enforcement, the community as well, to be on the lookout, you know, for these issues and problems. It's something that's going to take everyone's help. And the good news is we're very fortunate in Hamilton County to have a lot of good partners working together, and we have a lot of things already in place to help combat this problem.
Aaron, what are your thoughts?
I would agree with what the Attorney General and Julie mentioned about the need for collaborative effort and the efforts that have been happening already to raise awareness. But really taking this multidisciplinary approach is really imperative, as Julie was saying, to ensure that we're not letting anything fall through the cracks. A recent study by Dr. Celia Williamson in 2012 was a survey study of individuals who identified as engaging in commercial sex, and a lot of questions were asked to get an understanding of what their lives were like. And a lot of those individuals indicated that they had reached out to child welfare workers, law enforcement, educators, and other members of their community who just weren't aware of the issue and so weren't aware of how to help and how to support their recovery. And so when we're looking at this multidisciplinary approach, it's so imperative not just to each individual, but to combating the issue as a whole, to inform legislation, to improve law enforcement and community emergency response. And the Attorney General mentioned that there's a commission, and I think that's a key element that we have at the state level and we have locally, where we can bring key partners to the table and we can discuss what we're seeing and how we want to be responding. And so there's a lot of great efforts going on now, but there's definitely more to be done in raising awareness and encouraging collaborative response.
And Mary Carroll, what about you?
Well, I would say, again, just thank you to the Attorney General for taking the leadership role at a statewide level. I was struck by a couple of things he said. One is that it's difficult to determine how prevalent this is. I think we're talking about still a hidden problem that a lot of people don't know what they're seeing. I think in the issue of women involved in prostitution, it's a little more visible. But the other thing that I was struck with was his talking about a child is just a child. And when we look back at the women who have been through the Off the Streets program since 2006, we know that well over 50% were trafficked as young girls. And so as females growing up, that was part of their legacy and part of their history. So we didn't know to call it human trafficking when we were doing our research back in 2004 and 5, but we know that so many of the women who have come through our program have been human trafficked as children. They continue, a large proportion continue to be trafficked and under the domain of someone in their adult life, but they've been conditioned to that way of life. And so, again, just agreeing with Julie and Aaron, I think in our community, we have so many positive things going on. I mean, we work very closely with Aaron's organization, with End Slavery. We're working with the court system, with Judge Heather Russell in a new change court specialty docket. This is all very good news because we're putting resources in our community to truly help children and grown-ups who are victims.
Julie, I know it's hard to get an idea and get a handle on how prevalent this is across the nation, and probably even in Hamilton County, it's difficult to know how prevalent it is. Do we have any ideas where this activity is taking place in our community, though? Is it an urban thing? Is it more of a suburban thing?
You know, I wouldn't want to limit it to one. You can't limit it to one community or one area. It's the kind of crime that could happen really almost anywhere. As Mr. DeWine mentioned, there are certain factors that are important. Highway access is something that typically is seen, you know, certain maybe motels or, you know, that kind of a resource for these people. But you can't rule out, I'd be afraid to rule out any neighborhood or any area.
I would just add that in addition to what Julie is saying, that, yeah, it's really about the landscape of the community. So when we look at it nationally, we see labor trafficking, we see sex trafficking in hotels, on the street, in our restaurants, in homes through domestic servitude. But, you know, a community like Hamilton County, we might, or in downtown Cincinnati, we might more often see sex trafficking on the streets than we would maybe in some of the more suburban communities where there isn't as much street access and where we see it in the hotels. And we're more likely to see trafficking through labor trafficking in agricultural communities where there are farms, as opposed to in the cities where we might see more labor trafficking in factories. So we definitely see a variety of different networks in this community, and it just really depends on the landscape and what kind of the environment looks like as to what types of networks we're seeing.
Mary Carroll.
Yeah, and just to follow up on Aaron, again, the women that we have been working with and who we are aware who end up in the streets of Cincinnati are coming from many of the suburban neighborhoods, as are the men who are engaged in the purchase of sex.
Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about human trafficking, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. We're talking about human trafficking and efforts to stop it. My guests are Aaron Meyer, Coalition Manager for the Anti-Human Trafficking Coalition, End Slavery Cincinnati. Julie Wilson, Chief Assistant Prosecutor and Public Information Officer with the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. And Cincinnati Union Bethel Executive Vice President and Director of the agency's Off the Streets program, Mary Carroll Melton. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Mary Carroll, you were making a comment about prostitutes getting used to that way of life. And many people don't understand how someone can stay in that way of life. Why don't they just stop and leave? How hard is it to get people to understand how just hard that is for folks who are trapped in human trafficking?
Well, I think one of the things that I look back at when we started the Off the Streets program, we did a lot of research. And one of the things we did was we interviewed 100 women in our local Justice Center in Hamilton County. And looking at, now all of these are incarcerated women, but we looked at women who've been involved in prostitution and those who are incarcerated but not involved. And here are some dramatic differences. We have women who reported being sexually abused and emotionally abused as a child. Women who have been prostituted were at like 77% reported that, and women who had not been is under 50%. So right there, as a young child, you grow up being a victim, and you grow up feeling a sense of no worth, and that the normally the men in your life are in charge. So where do you go to get that a different role model? So they grow up. We have families, just like Julie was talking about, and Mr. DeWine was talking about, a mother who is selling her child for sex. It becomes so prevalent and so prominent that that identifies who they are. And I think that the other interesting statistic that I was telling Julie about is that over 34% of the women that we interviewed had been homeless before the age of 18, compared to only 14% of the women who hadn't been prostituted. So you just look at your life pattern, and how do you break that pattern? Truthfully, that is why the Off the Streets program was started, is that what can we do to intervene? These women are victims, and they don't want to live their life as a victim. But how do you help them begin the life skills, or to build the life skills that they need to literally know that they have a choice and that they can make positive changes?
Aaron, maybe you can comment about the other side of the issue. The other side of human trafficking is forced labor. So the question becomes, Why is it so difficult to get out of that? Why not just run away?
Well, and I would argue that a lot of the mentality is similar. So nationally, studies support what the Off the Street study says, that sex trafficking victims, the majority had survived some sort of abuse as a child. The average age of entry into commercial sex in the United States is 13. So again, that shift in mentality and in building confidence can really help for someone to feel comfortable enough to leave their situation. In labor trafficking, there are different barriers, but some of the mentality is the same, particularly as it relates to domestic servitude and other types of labor trafficking. The trafficker may exploit cultural norms to make that individual feel that they can't leave, or else they'd be shaming their family or their community. They may be moving off of an expected distrust of authority, and indicating that if you leave that community, even if that person is undocumented, if you leave this home, you're going to get arrested and deported, because maybe in that person's home country, law enforcement is not to be trusted. And so it's still about creating that culture of fear, but it's just a little bit different, some of the vulnerabilities that are there. But the trafficker creating this sense among those that are being victimized in that network that there is no other option should they leave, or should they leave, something bad will happen.
And as prosecutors, what we see when we talk to victims on these kinds of cases or other similar sorts of cases, you have victims who don't have an education. They might not speak, English might not be their first language. They don't have supportive friends or relatives. They don't have the network that so many of the rest of us are lucky enough to have. So when you have those barriers to trying to get out of, you know, to make a change in your situation or to do something else, it's very, very challenging and very difficult. So again, I come back to why it's so exciting in Hamilton County that we, you know, have focused on this problem and have so many people working together, because that's really the key. Law enforcement can't do it alone. The social services agencies can't do it alone. It's really important, and we found this in other situations as well, that when we work together, we have the best results.
How difficult is it, Julie, for prosecutors and law enforcement to distinguish between the offenders and the victims?
Well, you know, in so many cases, and this is not just on this particular issue, but, you know, someone can be a victim on a case, and then 2 weeks later, they're charged as a defendant. So a lot of these issues are so intertwined, and the problems, you know, go for both potential victims and potential defendants, or, you know, we see very similar sorts of things often.
How much do we know about the people who are committing this type of crime? Is this pretty murky too, like the prevalence issue itself?
And maybe Aaron can speak to that.
Oh, I would just say there was a study out there a little while ago called From Victims to Victimizers. It was an interview of several different traffickers, particularly pimps, and it throughout that study, they found that 90% of those that were traffickers either had been sexually abused as children, or family members in their lives had been traffickers as well, or had been pimps as well. And I know in some local cases here, we've seen some pimps who started as maybe low-end drug dealers as children in gangs. That's not true always, but oftentimes what we are seeing with traffickers is kind of this, similar to the victims, of this idea of growing up thinking that this is okay, and this is the way you interact with your environment. And so it can be really difficult when then you're trying to kind of differentiate between what can be called the bottom in a trafficking family, an individual that maybe started being victimized by the pimp, but then now is kind of in a more managerial role and might be responsible for recruitment or grooming the new women. It's hard to then decide, I'm sure, as a prosecutor, whether or not you should look at them as what happened to them previously as a victim, or as a trafficker now.
And that is something that I will say, I think, you know, one good thing, the sensitivity around this issue is that we do evaluate the victims of this situation hopefully much more sensitively and look at, you know, the underlying problems. And maybe historically law enforcement had not been as sensitive, but I think now we definitely are seeing that new sensitivity, which is very, very welcome and important.
So it's a paradigm shift. You're looking at the victims a little differently these days.
I think it would be fair to say that, yes.
Yeah. And I would just add again, I'm going to go back to our community collaborative back in 2005 that really planned the Off the Streets program for over a year. One of our largest and most significant partners in that was the Cincinnati Police Department, because they see the women on the streets all the time, and they were tired of seeing the women who seemed to have no way out of this perpetual lifestyle. And they continue to be one of the biggest champions for women accessing help and services. They, in fact, are the ones who approached Judge Russell because they said, is there a way that we can reengage the court in a more specialized, focused area to try to bring wraparound services to the women? And Aaron's group and Off the Streets is involved in that, but so are many of the area treatment providers. So again, I think raising the cultural awareness, the sensitivity, and in fact, I think that some of it is the language change too. We don't refer to the women in our program as prostitutes because they are not what they have done to survive. We talk about them being prostituted women, victims of prostitution. And now when you hear police officers referring to women in that way, that's just very gratifying, because you realize there is a cultural shift in how we are viewing this issue.
And one thing that I want to make clear, I don't want to make this sound like it's all perfect and we don't have any problems, because certainly we still do, but it is still challenging as prosecutors, because often the women in this situation, they, you know, are reluctant to come forward, they're reluctant to cooperate with the police because, you know, perhaps some of these historical issues that we've discussed are still in the back of their minds or whatever. But definitely, you know, we want to reach out to people, and we certainly want to urge cooperation, because that's what we... how we can be successful with law enforcement, so we have the cooperation of the people who are the potential victims in this situation.
No, I can understand the difficulty, because it seems like it's something that just operates in the shadows, and everything is just so murky about all this.
Well, and as Aaron had mentioned, I mean, a lot of these victims, they're so afraid of, you know, the people who have trafficked them. They, as I said, that with educational difficulties, perhaps language barriers, there are a lot of factors that go into it that make it these very difficult cases.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Dr. Will Sawyer. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi. Thank you very much for taking the call. It is absolutely a complicated issue. And when Mike was on the phone talking about no mercy for the traffickers, and my question is, how much mercy can we show to the victims? As you've all noted, it's recurrent issues, et cetera. And mine as a doc is young women who get pregnant and they didn't want to be in safe access to health services, termination process as well. So I would love to open that up, because that's a huge part of caring for the whole person, so to speak.
Access to health services. Well, thank you, Dr.
Yeah.
Sawyer. We appreciate the call.
Well, I would just jump in and say, I think access to health care is critical for everyone. And I think especially for women, again, one of the things that we are able to help women do is to connect them with a health care provider. They have a medical exam with the Cincinnati Health Network, so that we want to immediately get them connected with a home health provider so that they can take care of a myriad of issues that they have had from a life on the streets.
And I would add, I also run the Salvation Army's anti-human trafficking program who works with other service programs like Off the Streets and Lighthouse Youth Services and many other First Step Home, many other providers in the community to kind of help fill in the gaps, again, providing that wraparound service. And definitely we work with partners like Cincinnati Health Network, Greater Cincinnati Behavioral, University Hospital, Good Samaritan Hospital, to be ensuring that there is that immediate access to care. Talking about it's not perfect and there are still some gaps. One of the biggest gaps that we face, though the Center for Chemical Addictions Treatment is a wonderful program, they still just don't have the capacity that the community needs at this point. And so access to detox services can be a real challenge in this community right now in right. terms of immediate health needs. Again, through no fault of any of the service providers, it's just that the demand has increased and it's just much larger than the capacity we have right now in this community.
Right. And I think the demand goes right along with the rise in heroin. Mr. DeWine mentioned the rise in heroin use, too, that there just aren't enough medical detox services. And I think you could talk to anyone from providers to law enforcement, prosecutors, and everyone will tell you that has significantly impacted the availability of anyone moving past that, the heroin addiction. Again, another partner has been the Sheriff's Department. Major Charmaine McGuffey has been part of this overall change court process. And the way they are really looking at providing more services so that they can be responsive to people who come into the Justice Center, they want them to leave connected to services so that they're not recycling back through the jail. So again, you know, 10 years ago, people might have said, this is a really unlikely partnership and collaborative, but I will tell you, it's just wonderful to see the system and the foundation in Hamilton County. Despite, as Julie said, there are still many gaps, and we could be doing a lot more, but with the resources we have, we are really collaborating.
So these collaborations and these support systems, they're very crucial, right?
They're absolutely critical.
100%.
How do you keep those growing?
Well, I think always being open. I know through our coalition, and I know Off the Streets has regular community meetings. End Slavery Cincinnati has monthly meetings every third Thursday at the Interact for Health building at 3:00. And that allows for new individuals or representatives of agencies interested in this issue to come, find ways to get involved. We have more specific committees depending on what people are interested in. But really providing a consistent opportunity for people who learn about the issue and want to get involved to have that opportunity.
And Hamilton County residents should be very proud of themselves, because we are so fortunate here to have partners who work well together, people who do want to cooperate. As Mary Carroll said, often you would think from very different points of view and perhaps not natural partners, but we're very fortunate in this community. I can tell you from speaking in other communities or to other law enforcement agencies, this is not something that's normal across the country necessarily. I mean, we're lucky to have this here, and people in Hamilton County should be very happy about that.
Julie, from the legal and the law enforcement side of things, what kinds of efforts are underway in Hamilton County to fight human trafficking?
Well, as Mr. DeWine mentioned, I mean, there is a state law. It's relatively new, and there have been a few changes to it still being tweaked. In Hamilton County, the case that we referenced earlier about the mother and the drug dealer, that is our first state court prosecution involving a human trafficking charge. We have had some federal cases here, but the law has, you know, the legal system has responded with a specific law, and law enforcement is informed and actually, you know, keeping an eye out for these cases and working with other agencies to make sure we try to keep a handle on it and all work well together.
I'll just add, through the working group, we've worked with the prosecutors, Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office, and also collaboratively with law enforcement agencies like Cincinnati Police Department, the FBI, Homeland Security Investigations, and other Blue Ash Police Department, other smaller jurisdictions, Norwood Police Department, and several others in the greater Cincinnati 275 loop, but also through Butler, Warren, Claremont, Brown, and Adams County.
How is the training for law enforcement on this particular topic? Is it getting better?
There are a lot of efforts at this juncture to improve it. So it's now been mandated for the past about 2.5 years, and so I think they've gotten the opportunity to get a sense of what the kinks are, and they've been working on that to include more information.
And I know that at least two prosecutors from our office went to a very long training on human trafficking. So I know they're out there; they exist now. How many law enforcement agencies have been able to avail themselves of that? I'm not sure, but at least locally, we have had some very important trainings take place.
Yeah, in addition to the mandatory, there's also some supplementary ones, as Julia is referencing, for investigative techniques as well.
Mary Carroll, you were on the show, it's been about a year ago, and you actually had one of the clients of your program on. I'm just wondering, how is she doing these days?
Well, I'm really glad you asked about that, because it really brings back the issue too. We are talking about real people, real women, real women's lives here. The young woman who was with me was just getting ready to graduate a little over a year ago. And I will tell you that today she has her own apartment. She has a job. She is just finalizing the process of regaining full custody of her children. And she has just re-enrolled in college. And that sounds like a lot in a year,
but it does.
But she had been working toward regaining custody of her children the whole time that she was in the Off the Streets program. That's one of the things that when you get a safe place to really kind of regroup and focus on what you really want to have happen, then we connected her with the people that could help her walk through that court system to get to regain custody. But she had to be able to prove to the courts that she was going to be a stable, healthy mother who could raise her children. And so, again, Julie and I were talking before the show, just think of the systems that are impacted by one person's life. I mean, now hopefully she's raising a young child who is going to be raised in an environment very different from her. She was a victim of human trafficking. She started in prostitution out of her family at a very young age. Her child, or her children, she has more than one, are going to have a different role model for their formative years. So hopefully they're not going to be the statistic that ages out of a ward of the state or homeless before they're the age of 18.
Well, that is excellent. Good to hear she's doing well. And what's the success rate like for your program? How good is it?
Well, you know, we're dealing with a population of people who have had very tragic circumstances, and we've been keeping stats since we opened the program in 2006. And just last year alone, we served over 75 women. But since the program started, we've served over about 720 women. And the statistics have held up pretty closely year to year. And the women who complete the program, about 90% report no future involvement in prostitution. And we go back and check court records because we want to be able to demonstrate to our stakeholders what's effective and what isn't. And we now are at about a 75% rate of no future convictions. And coming from a population who are probably arrested 20, 30, 40 times a year, that's a pretty significant outcome. I think right now the biggest challenge is really not getting drawn back into the whole heroin issue. So we're seeing a little decrease in women who have relapsed. And again, being able to get reconnected to services immediately. Relapse, unfortunately, is often one of the pathways to recovery. But being able to have these wraparound services to be able to quickly engage a person again is really significant. So I would say the women themselves have worked really hard to absolutely demonstrate and change their lives. They've gotten stable housing, they've gotten legitimate sources of income, and the impact on their children is just life-changing.
We'll continue our discussion about human trafficking, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us today are Aaron Meyer, Coalition Manager for the Anti-Human Trafficking Coalition End Slavery Cincinnati, Julie Wilson, Chief Assistant Prosecutor and Public Information Officer with the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office, And Cincinnati Union Bethel Executive Vice President and Director of the agency's Off the Street program, Mary Carol Melton. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And John from Northern Kentucky called in with a question. He said, can you address the young men who are involved in prostitution themselves? Are they also considered victims? Because at this point, we've been talking a lot about women who are trapped in the sex trade.
I would say absolutely, because although we have not personally done the research on the young men the way we did on the young women, you can look at national statistics, and I would dare to say that the same stats that I said about young women growing up in families where there was sexual abuse, emotional abuse, early trauma, you could translate that into young men who themselves are involved in prostitution. And I think we don't have the same level of coordinated services for that population.
Yes, we certainly see that population being exploited here in the greater Cincinnati area as well. Lighthouse Youth Services and the Salvation Army have street outreach programs that work with LGBTQ youth, along with also women and other runaway and homeless youth, to connect them with resources. But we certainly see that commercial sexual exploitation and trafficking is occurring among men who identify as men and men who identify as women, and just generally that population. And I know Lighthouse serves that population, but there is definitely still a gap. There was a study recently that came from the Urban Institute. It was about the LGBTQ population and human trafficking in New York specifically, but I imagine a lot of the statistics from that can be extrapolated to Cincinnati and other cities in the country as well.
And only I want to add that the law certainly provides for a male or a female victim. There's no difference. So the law as it's written would apply to whether the victim is male or female.
Julia, has there been a change in the way that those charged with soliciting has the way they were treated? Has it changed over the last 10 years?
In terms of penalty or?
I guess we were talking earlier about the paradigm shift where now it's, you can consider them more to be victims who need help. I mean, is that all shifting? And I guess, yeah, talk about penalties. Are they being treated any differently? Do you have more discretion than maybe you did in the past where you can say, look, I understand this has been a problem for you. Let's get you help instead of running you through the court system.
Well, I think as Mary Carol mentioned earlier, I mean, certainly law enforcement has taken a look at that, has reached out to the court system to say, hey, wait a minute, let's look at the big picture here. You know, what do we want to accomplish? Are we hoping to get the person the right help so they're not, you know, back in court? And I think that the fact that we have the human trafficking law certainly speaks to the fact that we recognize, hey, there's an issue here that had not been previously addressed. We need to have a law that would deal with that specifically.
So they're giving you a little more flexibility in dealing with this, I take it.
I think so, yes.
And I would add that in the Ohio Revised Code, the law that was passed, HB 262 in 2012, did add this safe harbor concept, and that's specifically for minors. So again, we've been mostly talking about adult women and a little bit about minors, but specifically for minors, there is this opportunity for diversion as opposed to punitive action, so that if someone is arrested for engaging in commercial sex, they may have the opportunity for engaging in a diversion program as opposed to being detained in a facility.
And I would just add, just talking about men in general, we also run a men's education program for men who are arrested for soliciting sex. And I think that locally, Councilmember Yvette Simpson's office and herself, I mean, personally, over the last 2 or 3 years, has become very involved in looking at the impact on communities with the issue of prostitution in their communities. And she has introduced city ordinances that increase the penalties for men who are the ones soliciting sex, and it's beginning to make it's definitely beginning to make an impact. So we're looking at both sides, at the demand side and also the victim side.
And to follow up on what Mary Carol said, I believe the city of Cincinnati now, for the buyers of sex, I believe if their car is impounded,
that's right,
the city,
yes,
increased the
they did
the amount what,
yes,
you have to pay to get your car back. So, and oftentimes those financial penalties really hit home with people. So I know the city has done some things like that.
Yes. And actually, when we started the men's program at the same time that we started our women's program in 2006, they have to pay a fine to attend the one-day education program. And that money is turned back into helping provide the services for the women. That's exactly why that was put into place. And so, I will also say that the providers who come and speak to the men, we also try to connect them with community resources. We know from the demographic information, there are men from every walk of life that you can imagine. And there are also men who need services themselves for sexual addiction.
Julia, you were talking about something earlier. Is the key to reducing this to start addressing the demand side? You think, is that going to help it immensely?
Well, I'm certainly not, a psychologist, or I don't want to speak to an issue that I'm not qualified to speak to, but I think you have to look at the whole picture, and you certainly can't rule that out. And perhaps Aaron, has more information on that issue. But, I would think you have to look at everything, and you certainly could rule out the demand side.
I mean, people consistently say that this is the oldest profession, or whatever it is that people say, and making that argument, people wouldn't be feeling that they can profit off exploiting someone for buying sex if nobody wanted to buy sex. And so if you're able to address some of those needs, as Mary Carroll was stating, traffickers work really hard to make it look like it is just a woman who needs money and a man who wants sex, and that very easy exchange. And that is not the case. There are many other factors there. So having that John School that Off the Streets program has to educate individuals, inform them that what is really happening is really imperative, making it more and more inconvenient through city ordinances and laws that impound the car. I know Representative Federer had initially introduced HB 130 with a spousal notification clause, which suggested that a letter would go home to the spouse of the individual buying sex, that they had just been arrested for buying sex. So again, making it didn't end up passing through, but making it more and more inconvenient for those who are purchasing sex can reduce them, this kind of cultural, again, talking about this mindset shift, reduce this kind of cultural acceptance of it, that it's just a boys will be boys type of situation, and it's not that it's the exploitation of women and men.
And the one thing I would say to add on these cases and other cases that people hear about, what you hear about on the news is the very sanitized version of the facts. People, I think most people would be very shocked if they knew all the facts that, as a prosecutor, I'm aware of and how disturbing these cases are. I think people would be even more upset than they are probably right now listening to our show.
Aaron, from the side of forced labor, if the government cracked down harder on employers who use trafficked labor, now would that be something that would help put a dent on that side of the human trafficking problem?
Sure. So the demand question as it relates to labor trafficking is very complicated. There are several different initiatives through the State Department and some other agencies to ensure that there's better oversight of some of these visa programs, because it's not just undocumented individuals that are being exploited through forced labor. It's also individuals who are coming into the United States legally on work visas. So there's been a lot of efforts to raise awareness among those visa holders and to increase oversight of those supervisors and employers. But when we think about labor trafficking and the demand, so sex trafficking, it's a person that we can see their face buying sex.
Correct.
When we talk about labor trafficking, if we all took out our phones, there's minerals in there that have been mined, and most studies suggest that child labor and labor exploitation is used to mine those minerals. And there's parts from all different walks, all different parts of the country that we just don't know enough about the labor practices there and about the company's particular practices, nor does our government necessarily have the capabilities to enforce our U.S. laws in those different sovereign countries. And so because we live in such a globalized culture, it's very difficult for us to get an understanding of, in reality, how we as consumers are contributing to the demand issue as it relates to labor trafficking. There are websites like Slavery Footprint, and Not For Sale has an app on your phone that you can scan a barcode of a product to see if it's been if labor trafficking has been used in that product and suggest alternative products, but it's only based on the data that we have. So there's only so many reports that can inform us as to the safety of the products that we're buying and whether or not there's exploitation involved. And there's just so much that we don't know about that. The U.S. government has started several different laws, and California has a supply chain transparency law to try to impact that. but it's so globalized, it's going to take quite the effort to get us there.
Is the federal government doing enough on this issue?
The federal government has done a lot from both the legislative area, from the White House perspective. The White House declared January Human Trafficking Awareness Month. They have a working group that works on it. There was the Justice for Human Trafficking Victims that recently came up in Congress that I'm not going to talk too much about because of the contention surrounding it. But there have been lots of federal initiatives. There's an agency called ATTEST, Alliance to End Slavery and Trafficking, and they're kind of the national law legislative response. And the government has been doing a lot, but there's certainly holes there, and particularly as it relates to working with United Nations and other countries abroad to kind of reduce that supply chain challenge that we have.
Mm-hmm. I would just like to sort of bring back just a final message locally, because like I said, I know that the women that we work with every day are somebody's mother, aunt, mm-hmm. sister, best friend, next door neighbor. These are real women in the case of the population that we serve. And if someone is listening, you know, I think this cultural shift, the partnerships that have been established, the police being part of this, the word is getting out on the street to these women that help is available. And that is so key. They might not be ready right now today to access that help, but they're going to continue to get that message. We also, along with Salvation Army and others, do outreach literally on the streets. We want women to know that when they are ready and we can help them feel like they can get in a mind frame where they are ready, that they can access services. So I would want anyone who is listening or anyone who has a woman in their life that they think needs services to know that they can probably go on your website and find out how to access
any one of us. We do have a lot of links on there to various resources. So yes, they're at WVXU.org.
And I would add that if anyone's listening, not locally, that there is a national human trafficking hotline that individuals can call. It connects locally to partners here like the Salvation Army and End Slavery Cincinnati. But it is a 24-hour hotline. Anyone across the country can call. Or they're connected globally, actually, now to global networks. So anyone from anywhere can call to get connected with resources in their community to get that support.
So if someone suspects they've seen or witnessed a human trafficking incident, Julie, what should they do?
Contact the local law enforcement agency right away. They'll start an investigation and then take it from there to, you know, wherever it needs to go. But with any kind of possible crime, call the police.
I would add contacting the local or the national human trafficking hotline can help too, as there's still some learning from the law enforcement end in terms of investigative response and who to connect with. Just kind of doubling down on those calls can ensure that the appropriate human trafficking working group and task force that works with Julie so closely gets that information and it doesn't fall through the cracks.
We've got about a minute left in our conversation. Talk about some things you'd like to see happen to help deal with this situation. Aaron, where would you like this to head?
Oh, that's such a great question. I think that, you know, I think the collaboration that we see now is so great and it is so imperative to a successful response. There are certainly still areas where we have room for improvement, particularly as it relates to labor trafficking. You know, we talked only briefly about that on the show. There really aren't a lot of provisions in the state law or local ordinances that react to the needs of labor trafficking victims or further support ensuring that they're safe and kind of finding ways for law enforcement to react to labor trafficking. So greater awareness about that issue in particularly, I think there's a lot of room for growth there in this community.
A few seconds left. Mary Carroll, what would you like to see happen?
I would say the continued collaboration. I would say recognition through some of our funding partners that this is a critical issue for our community. And it's not always just about money, but we do need additional resources.
Aaron, Julie, and Mary Carroll, thanks for joining us today. Aaron Meyer is Coalition Manager for the Anti-Human Trafficking Coalition End Slavery Cincinnati. Julie Wilson is the Chief Assistant Prosecutor and Public Information Officer with the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. And Cincinnati Union Bethel Executive Vice President and Director of the agency's Off the Street program, Mary Carroll Melton. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Bruce Ellis. I'm Mark Haney.